The writer Chris Onstad used to work at a Silicon Valley tech firm. He drew cartoon characters in his spare time, which soon became a new career.
The relatively unproven concept of making a living off of a web comic.
A web comic. Your newspaper comic page may be getting smaller, but one source, the webcomiclist.com, counts 12,000 comics online. Chris Onstad's comic strip, Akewood, is among the most acclaimed. That's A-C-H-E, Wood, Akewood. It depicts a stark world in black and white. The characters are coarse, but their inspiration was cuddly.
I sketched out some of my wife's stuffed animals, and I put voices in their mouths. And over time, they actually grew into their own characters.
Well, now, let me just ask about that, though. These are stuffed animals that your wife has had since she was a little girl?
Yeah, and in a couple cases, some of these are 30 years old, sitting on a shelf in our house. Yeah.
Is your wife happy to go online and see that her stuffed animals swear, drink a lot, try to sell obscene products that we won't even describe on the radio, and do various other things?
Yeah, you have to buy the book for that.
In the book, those sweet stuffed animals commit acts of fantastic violence. The book is called The Great Outdoor Fight, which is a made-up extreme sport. Thousands of creatures brawl for days until all but one is torn apart. The story evolved as Chris Onstad posted strips online.
It happened totally by accident. What I do is I'm a cartoonist who works. I post, you know, 3-4 times a week in the mythical world called Akewood that I've made up. And I kind of think of The Great Outdoor Fight as something where, like Tolkien said, the tale grew in the telling. I had a character discover that his long-lost father had won this thing, and then he went to enter it himself. I wrote it day by day, and as a daily gag strip artist, I was really concerned that people weren't going to hang on for the 3 months it took to tell this online. But they did, and it became our most critically acclaimed piece of work ever.
Well, let's go to page 29 of this, if we can. I just wonder if you can describe a couple of your main characters here, because it gets us a little bit into this world that you've created.
On page 29 in the book, what we have is the two major protagonists, Ray, who's sort of the wealthy, chubby, happy-go-lucky, and Roast Beef, who's the depressive roadie who's helping him get to the fight, but he's actually more of a scholar of the thing. Roast Beef is explaining to Ray basically how the great outdoor fight will work once they get inside the grounds. You know, they're talking, they're on the road to Bakersfield, which is where the fight is held every year, and Ray's in the sidecar, being chauffeured to the great outdoor fight where he's expected to win because he's blood of a former champion. So Ray says, So what's the main thing I got to know going into this? The fight is 3 days, which is enough time for an ad hoc culture to form. Two armies typically arise and their pawns are sent to the front. It's rumored that the army leaders often fight only on days 1 and 3 and traditionally feast on turkeys and brandy on day 2. Damn, sounds like I got to be an army leader. Are there side dishes?
Now, I'm already just looking at the page, getting a sense of the different voices that you have assigned to these characters and the way that you've represented that online. Some of these guys are punctuated. Some of them are not so punctuated. Some people use capital letters. Some of them don't. Is there an online reason for that?
There's a grammatical reason. The character who speaks in a smaller typeface without punctuation is the depressive one who I like to imagine speaks in more of a low mumble most of the time. That's just my way of representing that visually. One thing I say time and again is comics are such a restrictive medium. I want to have sound so badly for so much of this stuff.
Well, let me ask about that, because here we are talking on the radio. And those of us who work in the radio know this is a very old, outdated medium. And we persuade ourselves that it's more powerful in a way because the voice is so powerful. And you don't have the distraction of an image and you really hear an individual's story. So I want to ask the same question about the comics. Even though it's old, outdated, limited, weak in a way, what is the power of it?
Just like with radio, your brain fills in so many of the blanks. If you look at the art here, it's fairly spare. This is more about the writing. And the richer I can make the dialogue, I think, helps people conjure up in their minds what they want these people to be.
It sounds like people have begun demanding that you fill in more blanks for them. You have blogs written in the voices of many of your characters.
Right. That I did because I was so pent up with, I had so much more I wanted to do with these characters. But even in the format I work in what I consider a sort of a Sunday format every time I post, which is 2 rows of 6 or 8 panels or more.
Bigger than the tiny daily comic that you'd see in a
Right. The tiny daily comic, I can't imagine how people work in that medium. It's so small. You can only have like 25 words in one of those or it looks too dense. And I can't get enough done with that. You can't make richness in that. I mean, sure, people will argue that, oh, well, Peanuts was rich. That was huge. But yeah, he did that over 50 years.
Yeah.
I'm like at capacity and how much I can produce, but still I feel like people are always demanding more. So I
that raises another question. This is something you hear about comic artists all the time, is the murderous demand of the deadlines.
See, since I work for myself, I regularly blow deadlines left and right like I was going duck hunting. People have great patience for me because typically a responsible man would write his cartoon a few weeks in advance and have it ready, and then it would go live every morning at 8 a.m. on some sort of dependable schedule. But, you know, I'm not doing a little single stripper every morning. I'm creating tales in the making. Sometimes they're really long, sometimes they're short. Sometimes, instead of doing a comic, I'll write a bunch of new blog entries for the characters, and people just have to roll with it. If they disappear, they disappear.
Given that this is a lot of work and that it keeps expanding, and you say that it's gotten to the maximum that you can handle at the moment, do you think about famous comic artists like, I don't know, Bill Watterson or Gary Larson, and I should say the authors of Calvin and Hobbes and The Far Side, people that did acclaimed work, and one day they said, I'm all through, I'm finished with this, I can't do it anymore, and pretty soon it'd be hard to even say where they were.
Yeah, those guys ran, I don't know, for about 10 years each, right? And they have really great standalone bodies of work. I don't see myself ending the Akewood daily strip just yet, but I really do want to branch out into other things. I don't just want to be a daily strip guy. And I think those guys like Watterson and Larson, they might look like, you know, silly little comics, but those guys put their heart and soul into those things, and they stopped because they had to, because I don't want to say they're well dried up, but you don't feel the same way forever. I like the characters in this body of work. I like the voices. I think they cover all aspects of the way I see the world. Not all aspects. But I've created a good vehicle for communicating with people, and I don't want to throw it away.
Chris Onstad is the creator of the online comic strip Akewood and author of The Great Outdoor Fight.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. For more than 50 years, actress and singer Diane Carroll has been breaking barriers. There have been Emmy, Oscar, and Grammy nominations. She was the first black woman to win a Tony for Best Actress and the first black woman to star in her own TV show while not playing a maid. That sitcom was called Julia. Diane Carroll has a new memoir out, and my co-host Michelle Norris had a chance to talk with her. Michelle, I gather that title character from Julia became the model for one of the first black Barbie dolls.
That's right, Melissa, and I actually had one of those dolls. My parents searched far and wide to find that Julia Barbie doll that looked just like Diane Carroll, and she had legs that seemed to go on forever. And so I chuckled to myself when I first spotted Diane Carroll's new book, because the title is The Legs Are the Last to Go: Aging, Acting, Marrying, and Other Things I Learned the Hard Way. Diane Carroll's still elegant, she's still headstrong, and she's still able to turn heads with those legs.
I'm going to admit I'm very proud of them. They are holding up amazingly well.
One of the themes in your book is scaling back your career, your lifestyle, your act on stage. The cover on the book, with you sitting in the director's chair with your legs crossed, is sort of an example of how you've scaled back and sort of let go. If you wouldn't mind just sharing with us the story of this cover shoot.
I was scheduled to have this shoot, so I thought I would prepare, and I was trying to use a water pill, but it backfired. I was supposed to go to the shoot, and I was almost twice the size that I was the day that I took the pill. And being a little anxious about the body, as one is when people have been talking about your body for 50-some-odd years, everything that I had sent from my darling Ann Fitzpatrick at Saks Fifth Avenue did not fit. I couldn't zip. I couldn't button anything. And so the photographer said, "This is my shirt." So we belted it, and we pushed and pulled at it, and we finally got the body shape that we wanted, in spite of the fact that I had about 5 pounds of water in me. But I remember the time when that would have been so traumatic for me that I don't think I would have been able to do it. But stepping away from glamour is not an easy thing to do.
The sweetest sounds I'll ever hear are still inside my head.
Diane Carroll's memoir is exceedingly honest. She writes about love and heartbreak and the racism she faced as a pioneer in show business. In 1962, she was the leading lady in the Richard Rodgers musical No Strings. A fan of the show offered to throw an opening night cast party. Everyone was invited. Everyone but the star, Diane Carroll. The party's hostess did not want Carroll in her home. The woman, who was white, said her children would be confused by such a glamorous, sophisticated black woman because she thought, quote, they did not exist.
And the woman that with whom Richard Rodgers was discussing this cast party asked that Richard Rodgers tell me that I was not invited and why I was not invited, because she knew that I wasn't a real person, that I was something that he created, and she did not want to confuse her children with a black person who was really of a white person's making, because she had never seen a black person like this. I thought this woman was possibly insane, but certainly, let's just, for the sake of whatever, be that she was misinformed.
When you were working on Broadway, you also write about working with Pearl Bailey, who was incredibly supportive at first, but then got very worried when you started to get a lot of attention.
Well, I've written in the book about the incident about a song that was in the show.
A song you were supposed to sing.
Yeah. Only to learn from the producer, Pearl loved the song and wanted to sing it. While we were both on stage, Pearl Bailey in a chair, my sitting on the floor next to her, that she was to lift my head, sing to me a few phrases, then turned my head upstage and she was supposed to turn it downstage. But
so she was singing the song that was written with you in mind,
right?
And was making sure that the audience was not able to see your face while she was doing it.
Absolutely. It was really one of the highest compliments and one of the most embarrassing moments in my life. Yes, it was horrible.
A compliment?
Yes, very much so. Think about it. Okay, time's up. Pearl Bailey was one of the biggest stars of our time. And that she felt not only did she want the song for herself, and also she wasn't anxious for my face to be facing the audience, which she felt that somehow that was a threat to her. So, yes, that was a compliment.
Mm-hmm. Do you understand why she did what she did?
Yeah, I do. Because I've gotten older now, and I understand it very much so. Youth can be very, very threatening. And I was very young.
What did I have that I don't have? What did he like that I've lost track of?
You've been married several times. You were engaged to David Frost. You had a long love affair with Sidney Poitier. What lessons did you learn from yourself in each of those relationships?
I'm a terrible romantic. I mean, just ridiculously so. It's immature, my romanticism. It will not sustain a relationship. I know that now. I think I could have been a good wife at some point, but obviously I didn't need that as much as I need my work. I love my child.
Your daughter, Suzanne.
My daughter, Suzanne, yes. Yeah. And we've had a very rough time, very, very rough time. But once again, I had to come to terms with what it is that propelled me forward most of my life, and that's my work. And I think she's come to terms in some ways with that, and some of it she's forgiven me for, some she may never forgive me for, but I can't change it.
It sounds like your grandchildren have brought you closer together.
Yes. Well, they're a gift from God, grandchildren.
Very well-dressed grandchildren.
Yes.
Thanks to you.
Well, it's part of my fluffy part. Yes, she really knows how to tease me. We were going to the theater one day with the children, and she arrived. She came through the door. She said, "Hello, it's Suzanne and family with children dressed by Diane Carroll." I loved every minute of it.
Thank you for spending time with us today. It's been
my pleasure. Really, it's a joy to be with you and to speak with you.
Diane Carroll, her book is called The Legs Are the Last to Go, Aging, Acting, Marrying, and Other Things I Learned the Hard Way. You can read an excerpt, see photos, and hear music at our website, npr.org.
What did he like that I'm not like? What was that charm I've run dry on? What would I give if my own know-how
Why read when you can listen? The business of audiobooks is a booming one. $1 billion worth of audiobooks were sold last year. That's 15% of all retail dollars in the book business overall. Part of the appeal of audiobooks are celebrities. Publishers often hire top-notch voiceover talent, famous stage actors, big-name authors, even the occasional movie star. As Nate DeMeo reports, sometimes great literature turns into not-so-great audiobooks.
Let's start with the gold standard.
Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of No. 4 Privet Drive were proud to say they were perfectly normal. Thank you very much.
Jim Dale's reading of the Harry Potter series amounts to a 115-hour masterclass in audiobook narration. And not just because of his pleasing tone and delightful Britishness. Dale has mastered the all-too-rare skill of distinguishing between characters without relying on wacky voices.
You do it, then, if you're so clever, Ron snarled. Hermione rolled up the sleeves of her gown, flicked her wand, and said, Wingardium Leviosa!
The guy moves so artfully from Ron to Hermione to Gilderoy Lockhart. It should be the platonic ideal for all school librarians and bedtime story readers. And that, in essence, is what the audiobook listener wants. Someone to read them a story, not act out a book. If only more audiobook producers felt that way. Audiobooks are bedeviled by gender and race, sort of like a swing state opinion poll. A hammy female narrator gruffing down her voice to do a noir tough guy is just not intimidating. And there's nothing less sexy than a femme fatale voice by a dude in falsetto.
What'd you do there? She asked. Nothing to talk to a lady about, Kelly replied. What makes you think I'm a lady?
While this bad gender bending can be annoying, racial drag can be offensive. Case in point, Sudhir Venkatesh's well-reviewed book, Gang Leader for a Day. The sociologist spent a decade in a decaying housing project in Chicago, a world most Americans only know from crime statistics or Hollywood stereotypes. But the audiobook is all Hollywood stereotypes. The reader is a white actor named Reg Rogers, and nearly every character is black. Unwisely, he tries to bring a little sound of the street to his reading. And it seems to be a street occupied by mid-1960s Sidney Poitier.
C-Note was challenging my authority, J.T. answered calmly. I had told him months before he couldn't do his work out there, and he told me he understood. He went back on his word, and I had to do what I had to do.
And so a book that is probably a great read becomes an audiobook that's nearly unlistenable. But mercifully, the last hour is read by the author himself. And Venkatesh is no professional voice actor, so he just reads you a story, without bombast or bad accents. And it reminds you that the people he's writing about are real, and not Hollywood caricatures.
When I asked T-Bone how he felt about the future, he soberly described his vulnerability as a lieutenant to JT. I'm not protected. That's my main problem, he said. I got nothing, so I have to be real careful. I mean, I save my money and give it to my mom. Like I told you, I want to get my degree and do something else with my life, start a business maybe.
Publishers are increasingly turning to Hollywood to bring a little star power to those nerdiest of industries. Matt Damon, Kevin Spacey, Sean Penn. Here's Brad Pitt trying out his Espanol in the audiobook of All the Pretty Horses.
An old man sat quietly against the wall, watching them. De que crimen que ha acusado el joven, he said. The man blinked. Assassinato, he said.
The skills required to narrate an audiobook clearly aren't necessarily the ones that help open a movie. An audiobook is not a book. When you curl up with an audiobook, there's another person there while you drive to work or walk the dog. Who wants to be stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic with a guy doing funny voices? For NPR News, I'm Nate DeMeo.
Joe Esterhaz was considered, even boasted of being, just about the baddest of the Hollywood bad boys. He drank from breakfast, did drugs during day and night, chased other men's wives with abandon. Along the way, he earned an estimated $30 million by writing screenplays. Some, like The Music Box, are considered classics. Some, like, let's say, Showgirls, Basic Instinct, Jagged Edge, are considered classic examples of Hollywood sleaze, violent, graphic, often nasty. Now Joe Esterhaz has written what many will consider his most improbable story. Shortly after moving back to his boyhood home of Cleveland, Joe Esterhaz developed throat cancer. In his struggle to survive and come to terms with himself, he turned to God and became a church-going, cross-bearing Christian. His newest book is called Crossbearer, A Memoir of Faith. Joe Esterhaz joins us from our studios in New York. Joe, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Should we explain your voice, by the way?
Yes. In 2001, I had surgery for throat cancer. 80% of my larynx was removed. The only reason I can speak is because the Cleveland Clinic did a radical experimental surgery where they took the muscles from the left side of my neck and attached them to what was left of my larynx. I couldn't speak for about 2 years, and I sounded very much like Brando in The Godfather. I had a trach for a very long time, but my voice has improved. And incidentally, I want to tell you, Scott, that I'm often complimented, especially by women, on the sexiness of my voice today. And my response is, you have no idea what I had to do to get here. But thank you very much.
Well, I was intrigued in reading your book that at one point you thought that maybe throat cancer was some kind of divine punishment for some of the things you'd said over the years.
Well, I always had such a big, nasty, and usually obscene mouth that I would scatter with various F-bombs and other forms of really tough expression. And when this happened, I thought, well, there, you really are paying the price, you know, for all of those years of firing that kind of stuff at people. I don't think that now. I think God is forgiving and God is loving and good. But I certainly thought about it for a while.
How did God enter your life? Could you recreate that for us?
In the most desolate moment of my life, which was shortly after my surgery, my doctors told me that I had to stop drinking and smoking or else I'd die. I started smoking when I was 12 years old and drinking when I was 14. I was at that particular point in 2001, I had been the classic functional alcoholic. Both smoking and drinking were tied into my writing, whether it was sipping white wine or coffee laced with cognac. I didn't think I could do this. A month out after my surgery, I hadn't had a cigarette or a drink in that time, but all of my nerve endings were a jangle. I had no patience with either my wife or my children. All I thought about, I was obsessed by the notion of having a drink or a cigarette. I walked each day to try to ease my cravings a bit. But on this particular day, a warm day in Cleveland, I went out walking and it was 90-some degrees. I still had my trach in my throat. I was sweating and shaking. I couldn't breathe. In the worst and most desolate moment of my life, I sat down on a curb and I started to cry. I cried like I cried when I was a little boy, actually watching my tears fall to the pavement. And I suddenly heard a voice inside me that said, please, God, help me. I knew I couldn't have said it because I couldn't speak at all. But I kept hearing this voice, please, God, help me. Please, God, help me. I stopped crying. I stopped shaking. I felt a sense of peace and solace. I opened my eyes. And for the first time, I thought, yes, I can do this with God's help. I can essentially win over my own self with God's help. I'm 7 years down the line, and I think my faith has deepened. And prayer and my faith, except for my wife and for my children, is at the very core of who I am. It really was a transformational experience. The reason I wrote the book is that I made a promise to God that if he would help me through this period, I would tell the world about it.
You note in the book at one point that looking back on it, God saved your life many times over the years. You just didn't see it that way at the time.
Well, I came to this country. I grew up in, my first 6 years were spent in Austrian refugee camps, first German, then English, and then American camps. We came to the United States, my mom, my dad, and I, when I was six. And I grew up on Cleveland's Near West Side. We were very poor. We were an immigrant family. You either had to fight your way through to get to the bus stop or negotiate. And sometimes I've said that I learned my greatest lessons about Hollywood right in front of Nick's Diner, you know, as I got to the school bus each day.
So what happened when Joe Esterhaz went back to Hollywood on business? And you were wearing a cross, right?
I was wearing a small silver cross. And, you know, a lot of people who had known me before looked at me agape. Some people thought that I completely lost my mind. Some of them said, look, you're going through a stage, and they brought Bob Dylan up to me with his conversion, and, you know, in those years when he did Christian music. And they said, well, you know, Dylan went through his period, so you'll go through your period too. And then we could go back to making money again. You know, I said, I don't think so, guys. This is the most important thing that's happened in my life. And of course I want to keep doing screenplays and I want to keep writing books, but I really don't want to write the kind of screenplay that I wrote before. So we'll see what happens. You know, I tried a script about St. Paul, and there was no interest in that. In terms of getting the kind of script made that I'm talking about now, a script that reflects my faith, I think that's going to be very difficult, because I do think that there is a kind of anti-Christian prejudice in Hollywood that is very tough to crack through. I used to say that Hollywood runs on greed, and that if the phone book gets, quote, hot, then they would film the phone book and put it up on screen. But, you know, even after the success of The Passion of the Christ and of Narnia, which indicates a gigantic, quote, market for Christian films, to put it in Hollywood terms, you know, whenever there's another kind of hit movie, and it's happened to me three times, they do 20 imitations of that movie until they totally burn it out. And after I did Flashdance, they did all dance pictures for a while, Jagged Edge courtroom thrillers, Basic brought in that kind of sultry thriller. You don't see that money train running on the Salvation track, even though it's been proven that there is a gigantic faith-based market.
Joe, what do you say to people, and maybe they don't say it to you directly, that what you're going through is just grief reaction?
Well, I'm 7 years down the line since I found God, and I think my faith has deepened. I've done a terrific amount of reading and trying to understand concepts of God. I spend a good part of each day in prayer. And the only thing I can really say is I know what it is that I feel. I know what's in my heart. And I know how I feel now as opposed to how I felt before. I think that everyone who has gone through a kind of transformational experience like I have will understand immediately what I'm talking about. But it's very difficult to explain that to those who haven't.
And why? I ask you as a novelist and screenwriter.
Because ultimately, Scott, we're talking about faith. We're talking about what's in the deepest part of our hearts and souls. And it really comes down to faith and belief. Mm-hmm. And if you dissect that purely with logic, you are led back to the wall that is what we call the mystery of faith. And that, of course, will always remain a great mystery. Some people find a faith and others don't.
What makes you sure God exists?
The best evidence to me is really what happened to me. Because without God's help, I knew I couldn't have done what I ultimately did.
Joe, thanks so much for all of your time.
Oh, Scott, thank you. It was terrific.
Joe Esterhaas, his new book is Crossbearer, A Memoir of Faith.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.